Welcome to Life Lab with David Ponder and Zach Schaefer. We are the podcast of experience experiments.
We give you those experiments via change challenges at the end of each episode.
We created this podcast because we wanted to talk about important topics that can help us all live meaningful lives.
You might agree with what we have to say, or you might disagree. But the point there is that you get something new to think about.
There's no edits and no gimmicks. Our entire point is to help you take action and live a better life.
You only get one life to live, so you may as well make the most of it.
Good morning, everybody. Zach Schaefer here.
And David Ponder. Hello, and welcome to Life Lab.
Today, we are going to talk about something that touches all of us, even if we don't have it, and that is trust.
Trust.
Last time we chatted, we were talking about lying, and so it's kind of fitting that trust follows lying, because if you're a giant liar, you probably have a very difficult time trusting others and getting others to trust you. What do you think?
Well, you know what trust is? It's the firm belief in the reliability, truth, ability, or strength of someone or something.
That's the definition.
That's the definition.
Yeah, when I think of trust, I mean, for me, one word that I can exchange with it, one synonym, would be belief, right? It's belief. If I have trust in someone, I believe they're going to hold their commitments. They're going to do what they said they were going to do. Why do I believe those things? Because they've done them in the past.
Yeah, absolutely. And I would say I kind of associate it with stereotyping. Why would you trust anyone, ever? It makes life so much easier, right?
Yeah.
If you had to vet out everyone for everything that they ever said that they ever were going to do, nothing would ever get done. Your life would just be spent vetting people out. Whereas if you're able to trust all the time, then life becomes easier. You know, symbiotic relationships are easy. Things get done better. Assuming there is no breakdown of trust. You know, which is why I think it's probably our tendency to trust is probably something that's tribal and evolved.
Trust to me, yeah. I mean, we're talking a little bit about chronology and time. Trust is like this magical, ephemeral dust, right? Because you can't see it, trust itself. We have proxies for it based on behaviors, right, and actions that we use. But trust to me is the connector of the past to the future.
That's right.
So yeah. Based on past things that have happened to us, whether it's as children and our caregivers, and I know you're going to talk about that, or as adults in our families or the workplace, or just out at a St. Louis Cardinals game, whatever occurred in the past will form these patterns and then will affect how we think about and project our trust or lack of trust into future situations and scenarios.
It's interesting you say that, because when I was researching for this episode, one of the things that I read was that trust is the juxtaposition of all of our hopes and dreams, like what we want out of something, with our greatest fears about the situation. So we have to put those two things against each other and then ultimately decide if we trust or not. I read that and I didn't think about it in the way that you just said that, but that kind of brings it to life for me.
Well, I'm glad I could bring something to life for you this morning. Here's something that I also think needs to be talked about. Trust might be one of the most taken for granted concepts that we have as a species. It's in societies where we have it, in stable societies, right? So I would think in Syria, in Aleppo, in areas that it is just ravaged with war, I would be curious to talk to those people about what they think about trust. Trust in their fellow man. I guess if I had to put myself in the spot, they might trust the people walking around on the ground a ton because they're part of that destruction and devastation, and have zero trust in anyone with any kind of authoritative position or position of power, because they've been lied to and manipulated and used as pawns for 30 years.
We're diving into the best stuff right up front.
Yeah, boy, we went deep quick. Sorry.
No, it's okay. I like this. I would agree with you. I've always had this thought, because I hear, you know, my parents and grandparents talk about what their neighborhoods were like when they were young, about how people depended on each other a lot more and relied on each other a lot more. And I've always wondered, you know, why is it that neighbors aren't as neighborly in the U.S. as they once were? And, you know, you can push against that statement, but I think it's probably true on some general level that, and you know, if you think about things like Halloween and these community things that we used to do in an open and trusting way, you know, I'm sure the media pumping fear and everything has broken down some of that trust and that has impacted it. But I think what you're saying is probably the biggest piece of it, which is whenever people experience hardships or tough times together, it pulls them closer and it probably builds those bonds of trust, you know. And so my grandma and her generation went through the Great Depression. You know, she told me that there was a Christmas where she got like an apple and she was thrilled about it, you know. And I would say just the opposite of the way that we are today, right? Like, so we've had an increasing standard of living. Everyone can be autonomous and have their own home and not be dependent on their neighbors and rely on their neighbors at all. And therefore, I think that maybe has led to a breakdown in that community trust, that community bond between neighbors. But
ooh, you know. Let's take, okay, so we went big, nation state Syria. Now we went community. Let's go down, relational. You have to know how to fight and deal with conflict and disputes with your partner. If not, your trust is very surface level, because when you have your, quote, war with each other, you're not going to know how to deal with that. You have to be able to go through those things together. Think about me and you, or you and a Bart, or me and Bart, or we can go on and on with our friends. One of the reasons that I always preach to freshmen, if I'm teaching a freshman class, is you got to get into and out of trouble with people. That builds deep relationships. Now, it'll tear others apart, and that is what it is. But the ones that
if
stay through it
occurs during it,
right?
You know,
or
what
just
I mean?
Even get, yeah, for instance, yeah, a rat, a snitch, just whatever. Yeah. But that, those friendships that make it through, those partnerships that make it through, there's real substantive trust there. And again, we even take it for granted.
We do.
And I see it when we meet other groups of people, and it's very apparent that they don't trust each other,
right,
themselves, definitely not our group. And man, we've just got that, I can't think of a good word, if not ephemeral.
Well,
like, you can't see it. What's it? What's the word I'm looking for? You can't see trust. It's a dust. It's that thing. We'll come up with
yeah.
it. But it's there, and it's keeping our cohesion together.
Yeah. No, it's like like you said, it's like dust sprinkled over everything. Mm-hmm. And it makes everything easier. And I think that ties back to what we said earlier, right? It's like there's this unspoken faith in each other. You know what I mean?
Yes.
So anyway, well, I'll say this. It ties back to, if you're talking about in between individuals, I will go to what you said, you know, we're talking about, which is where do we develop our tendency to trust, to be trustful or distrustful? And that's like, basically, psychologists think it goes back to the way that we were treated by our caregivers, you know, as a child. And so if you have good, constantly attentive caregivers who are always taking care of your needs, then you develop this secure belief in trust. You become a secure person, and you become, you know, more easily able to trust others. And then you have people who either were cared for inconsistently or not cared for at all, neglected, and maybe even abused. And those end up in this insecure category that then gets broken down by those two things. Number one, anxious, which is you worry that your partner won't be available or responsive at the time that you need them, right? So you don't trust them to be present, and you get anxious about being able to rely on them or not. And then you have avoidant, like, so for the people who are neglected or even abused, you know, you avoid close contact at all. You try to not allow those relationships to build to that level of closeness because you don't trust anyone at all and you want to remain autonomous. So it kind of goes to show, like, that lack of trust, either an insecure, anxious lack of trust where you're like, you know, you're close to someone but you're always doubting, or if you're like that avoidant person, that person that never can make close bonds with others, like those are like defects in your neurocircuitry that allows trust. And that I can see how that would hurt everything that you do.
You're less human. Yeah, we're connectors. Yeah. We're social.
Yeah, we are social.
And
yeah.
So, I mean, what do we do to someone? What's one of the worst punishments we give someone outside of the death penalty?
Excommunication, right?
Like excommunication, banning them, and solitary confinement. Yeah. We remove your ability to trust anyone and anything, to have any contact. To me, trust is actually, and then this hits on what you were talking about with building those trust tendencies as kids from caregivers. Trust is the outcome, an outcome or a result of many other things. And to me, that starts with communication, interaction. From there, collaboration, working through situations and problem solving and issues and disputes and conflict together. Then trust emerges. Which is, and it's simple to see, look at Congress right now. There's no trust across the aisles at all. It hasn't been for over a decade now. They don't interact. They don't communicate. The only way they communicate is with barbs at each other through the media. And when Gleason was working out there, you know, back in the 70s, 80s, even into the 90s, the two groups would go out to bars together. He said that happens none. They have separate spots where the Republicans go, the Democrats go. So, of course, they don't have trust because they're not even interacting, communicating. So there's no room for collaboration.
Two important things about what you said is you said the two groups, which ties back to everything that I was saying about how trust is like this. It's probably evolved from tribalism.
Yeah.
And you want to talk about tribalism at its, you know, worst.
Yeah.
I was going to say greatest, but no, worst. Republicans and Democrats, man.
Interesting. This totally isn't related to trust, but I just read something about a very famous, I believe he's still alive, behavioral economist who wrote about why he used to think the two-party system was terrible, and then in his later years, his thoughts evolved, and he said it's one of the greatest achievements we have in the U.S. Now, I haven't dove into his argument to read it, agree or disagree, but that's interesting. I'm going to find that.
Yeah.
Not here or there.
I'd like to read those arguments. Regardless, whatever it's devolved to at the current time,
right?
It would be very hard to argue that it's good.
Right. Well, okay, so let's talk institutional trust.
Yeah.
Right? That kind of gets back to the situation in Syria.
Well, can I say one more thing before you go?
Go ahead. Yeah.
You also said there's an evolution of trust where you first, you know, start having conversations and interactions, and then you move on to activities together. That brought up something that I had uncovered during my research, was that when researchers study trust, they think of it in two different ways, right? So they think of cognitive trust, which is it's based on your knowledge and evidence about those that you're choosing to trust, right? So it's logical almost. And then there's affective trust, which is born out of like your emotions and your ties with others. So the way that you were describing that was that you first start to have communications and build a foundation for trust with others through things that are just interactions,
yeah.
Right? There's no like heavy thing at stake.
It doesn't need to be strategic,
right?
Just talk.
So just build a foundation, start building some of that emotional affective trust.
Correct. Right?
And then only after a solid foundation of affective trust is built, would you then move on to things where like something's at stake and they can feel like they're ready to move on to that cognitive trust, where they logically think about whether they are able to trust you.
Yeah.
And maybe that's something that you were talking about with Jimmy saying. They used to go to the bars together. They used to hang out together. So maybe that affective trust, right, that emotional trust between the two tribes, Democrats and Republicans, that's what's missing right now.
Yeah.
And they're all trying to focus on this logical cognitive trust. Well, and they never
absolutely
get there.
And so there's trust at multiple levels there. Clearly, they view the world should be run quite differently according to different principles. What I view as a peasant looking in on the situation over there is it seems like they almost have no respect for each other. Like, you should respect your enemy. You should learn from your enemy. That's the art of war. I mean, it seems like that doesn't exist nowadays. So just because someone else has a different worldview than you doesn't mean you should hate them. Shit, if anything, you should learn from them to improve your own, or maybe borrow their best practices, et cetera, et cetera.
And I feel like the tactics probably have something to do with it. You know, like you said, if you learn to take lessons from your enemy and respect your enemy, it's very hard to respect your enemy when the tactics of fighting your enemy now come down to discrediting them in the media and socially shaming them.
Right.
Because then it causes you to lose respect
yes.
for them.
Well,
and you start to believe your own bullshit that you're spewing about them.
It's more than discredit. It's dehumanizing. Right. When I view them as not a human, as an animal, right? We saw that that's how masters did it to slaves for hundreds of years. That's what Nazis did to the Jews. When you create caricatures of people, thanks Mark Zuckerberg for that, by the way, that we can just blast that out there. That's great. You don't view them as a human. So then you don't even need to create that affective or feelings-based trust, because why would I? Do I trust my dog? If you don't view somebody as human, you don't even think about trusting them that way.
Yeah, I've heard about that during war,
mm-hmm.
right? Basically, like,
it's very subtle psychologically, but very powerful.
Yeah, you have to, like, in order to be able to do this, some of the things that people do during war, they don't think of the enemy as equal or as human. Yeah, it's a weird and it's an awful thing, but it's like,
it's also amazing that our brains
are able to
buy into that, and we're like, okay, yeah. Yeah. Let's do it.
We have to do these weird psychological yes. tricks. And I guess once they're at that level, then you would never, like, there's no ability to even consider, quote unquote, trust.
Or open mindedness or conversation.
Well, and it's because you don't trust anything that's not your equal.
Mm-hmm.
Right?
Yeah. Ants coming in?
Yeah. Like, we just talked about, I think when I read the definition of trust, it had something to do with belief in the reliability, truth, ability, and strength, right? Well, if you're talking about ability, you have to feel like someone at least is on the same level as you to have trust in their ability, or at least they're up to whatever task it is that you're trusting them to perform. And if you're taking someone down to some level where you are just tearing them down, disrespecting them on every front, there's no way you're going to ever be able to build any kind of trust. So anyway, I think that probably applies to what's going on in Washington right now.
Interesting. Two things. Here's a little trust bridge for those listeners out there. So Dave keeps talking about affective and cognitive trust. Well, there's a third term, behavioral, right? So think affective, cognitive, behavioral, fancy academic terms for what do I want someone to think or to feel, to think, and to do. Right. And so when we're talking about trust, as Dave's pointed out, we like to go to the logical side for verify. Right. So there's a famous phrase, trust, but verify. Have you heard of that?
Absolutely. Well, yes.
In your field, I think it's important in financial field. Do you know where it comes from?
I was going to say my field, but where's it come from?
It actually comes from a Russian writer. I forget her name. Susan something. She communicated that to Reagan in the early 80s. It comes from Reagan era. So everyone attributes it to Reagan, but it doesn't come from Reagan. And it's from a Russian proverb. And I guess Russians apparently like to speak in proverbs, and that's a very famous one. And I can't speak Russian, so I won't say it. But it's about trust, but verify. And to me, that's speaking to that American logical, very cognitive side, business-oriented side. And that's fine. I'm curious if the Russians have another one proverb for the affective side. Shared with Reagan.
I wonder too, because I've always heard that, and I've always thought that it's such bullshit.
Mm-hmm.
It's a contradictory
statement.
Exactly.
I was just going to say, do you believe the statement?
No.
I was like, it's like, I don't know.
So everyone knows, right? I do IT risk and security stuff, and on the risk side of the house, when you're talking about inspecting a process to see if it achieves its desired result, you oftentimes will interview the folks who are involved in that process or the way that they configured a certain system, and they may tell you, this is how we do it, or they may tell you, this is how we configured the system. But you always go get the screenshot from the system configuration and you include it in your work because you have to trust but verify, which, I mean, ultimately, it's a bullshit statement. And I'll say this, like,
so there is no, so when you say that, are you saying there is no trust? It's more just verify.
Yeah, there is no trust there.
Gotcha.
There's zero trust there.
Right.
Why,
I agree.
Why am I going again? And now, I'll say, like, I'll justify it because it's like, you got to understand what their motivation is. They want to keep their job, get good performance reviews, all this stuff. They're really disincentivized to be honest with you in that situation. and tell you, yeah, well, we understand the standard is this and the company policy is this, but we configured it differently because we needed to get something done. I've worked with people who do just come out and say that, and they're the best people to work with. Mm-hmm. I think, but ultimately, they're disincentivized to do that.
So again, it's from a proverb, so I'm sure we're pulling it way out of context. I'm sure there's a larger story, but that's not what's stuck in the American myth. I would prefer to think about talk but verify. I'll talk to you, but I'm going to verify what you're saying because that's different. I'm not saying I'm trusting you because I'm not.
It's in there, yeah.
Exactly. There is. I'm not trusting, but I'll talk to you. I'll hear, and then based on what you say, I'll go do my process.
That's
my
what it should say. It should be like interview but verify.
Yes, yeah, exactly.
Walk through but verify. Yeah, something like that because the word trust, it's like what I said in the beginning, man. If there's trust there, everything is quicker and easier because the need to verify isn't – you don't need to verify.
Right.
That's what trust is.
There's predictability there.
Yes, and that's why I also kind of tied it to stereotyping, because if humans didn't, it's like a cognitive trick or framework that allows us to operate as more efficiently. With stereotyping, we can look at something and make a bunch of assumptions about it, and then move on as if those assumptions are true. Without having to research it and learn all about it every time we see something that looks like that or whatever, right? So it basically makes us be able to do the things that we do. Without stereotyping, nothing would ever get done. Our life would constantly be inspecting, re-inspecting.
I also think, though, part of what you're talking about, I'm not disagreeing on the stereotype, but I also see it as we live in an authority-based system. We take people, systems, the past, traditions, at face value. This is the authority. Our everything in life is authority based. So we listen to the said author, right? The authority of what they're talking about. And we trust, we accept that. And that's why organizations like cults are really powerful, because they understand how hierarchy and system and trust specifically works. And they manipulate that.
Yeah.
In really smart ways that to do really bad things oftentimes.
Well, you know, here's an interesting thing. So everything that you said there is true, and it led me to think about how in advanced societies and Western societies, we're moving toward a scientific-based trust. We're moving toward trying to get more to that cognitive-based trust than anything else, right? So in every argument now with intellectuals, it always comes down to some sort of, well, what do the statistics show? What do the lab results show? You know, what's our science-based evidence for belief in that truth? And it seems like that's something that we're moving more and more toward as that's what we trust in now, right? We want to have this trust in
it's
concrete it's, numbers, logic, whatever.
So there's a lot of famous French philosophers that talk about that. And we mentioned actually postmodernism on the last episode. There's a very famous one called Lyotard, Lyotard, I believe. And he wrote a lot about grand narratives, and he believed that there were a few competing grand narratives. And he was writing about this. All the philosophers out there are going to hammer me. Maybe it was modern, so maybe 60s, maybe 70s. But the one that is trying to consume all other grand narratives is the grand narrative of scientific progress.
Right.
And so what he's saying is that grand narrative is intruding in what other people might call the life world. Right. In our home, how we do things, what we're doing right now, how we do things, the conversations we have with our kids. And I see that on all the articles. And I'm one of the people writing them on LinkedIn. Here's how you do this part of your life. Here's where you do this part of your life. Here are the results.
And you can trust it because.
Yes, because I'm an authority.
Scientific based evidence.
Yeah. Right? And so
this experiment shows.
And I'm part of that grand narrative progressing and consuming into every nook and cranny of our human lives.
Right.
It's like, am I going to get up one day and just, well, sure, they will get up one day and plug into the trust robot.
Right.
So I don't have to worry about trust. Then shit, robotics and trust. That's something I'm sure physicists out there.
Let me put a pause here because there's something really important that I don't want to lose, which is before we move on to this. But what I wanted to say was, I'm losing it now. Keep going.
Okay.
What were you talking about?
Robotics, just the fact that the idea of science, which is hypothesized.
Oh, okay, so here's where I wanted to go with this. Yeah. it's really interesting because you brought up postmodernism, and there's something interesting that's happening with this whole the belief in science overtaking every other ideology or something. And that is that typically the left and the intellectual crowd has been the one to advance the belief in the scientific thing. But let's tie back to intellectual freedom.
Mm-hmm.
Because there's this interesting contradiction now that's going on where you're not allowed to try to find scientific facts about certain things, right? We'll just talk about some easy ones. Gender, right? Race, right? So to actually try to look at scientific fact about race or gender and try to explain differences between those groups with scientific fact is something that the left now is deeming
off limits.
Off guard, off limit. Yeah, you can't do that. Like, you will be shamed for that. You know, they'll say, you know,
you're a racist. You're
not
you're
even
a sexist.
Yeah, you're a racist. You're sexist. You're not even allowed to explore those.
They
things.
Dehumanize you.
Yeah.
Going back to what we talked about earlier.
Exactly. And so it's interesting. The reason I bring that up is because when you do that, then to me, I can't even trust that there's an honest conversation going on back and forth. If you say you can't even use supporting evidence of certain types, or you can't even investigate supporting evidence of certain types, or else I'm going to label you as a racist.
Well, that's saying, that's like saying we are, sexist. I'm all about true intellectual freedom and progress, open dialogue and debate. Here are the rules of the game. You can't talk about these things, and you can't look at these types of reports, journals, or evidence.
Right.
Okay, so let's keep talking about these trust tangential topics, if you will. Cryptographic assets.
That's where I was going to go.
Crypto.
That's where I was going to go.
People that don't know much about crypto, my view, at its core, it is about trust.
It is about eliminating the need for trust.
Decentralizing trust. Spreading it out through a distributed network, right?
It's about distributing power to the point where no one has enough power that their distrust is impactful, that their betrayal is impactful. So they can betray the network, but it doesn't even matter because they're such a small piece of the network.
Right. The network will clean it up.
Yeah.
The network will remove the distrust.
It makes it... it does. It removes it, right? Because there's consensus.
Consensus is part of trust.
So consensus, that's the way that this technology works, is that...
Agreement.
You spread the burden across, quote-unquote, nodes that are geographically dispersed around the world, and that does a couple of things, right? If there are bad actors on the network who are trying to lie.
Game the network. Lie.
Literally lie. So let's just talk about this in its easiest sense and say cryptocurrency, money. So those nodes are tracking transactions. So if someone wanted to put a false transaction.
The double spend
to say, I spent that money. No, I didn't. Right. And so I spent it, but I want it to still appear like it's in my wallet. They could put out a transaction and then they could try to reverse that transaction. But the way that it works is once you put out a transaction, it starts propagating to other nodes around the network.
It's immutable. It's out there. You can't take it back.
And you can't undo it.
It's not. It's unhackable. You can't take it back.
And it spreads so fast that basically once you try to undo it, it's already out of control like wildfire. You can't undo it. And then you have – and 51% of the nodes around the globe have to agree that something is true for it to be accepted, for there to be quote unquote consensus.
Good. So let's not go down the crypto rabbit hole because we're going
to
do a whole episode on that. In case anyone's interested, myself, Dave, my brother and Dave's brother, Josh and Justin, you know, we have a little crypto group. And so we love talking about it. And we're going to do an episode, all four of us together soon. So if you'd like to learn more about crypto, that's going to be here.
But let me conclude there. So what that technology is meant to do is it's meant to take out the need for trust on any one actor.
It goes back to what we were talking about. Yeah. Trust but verify.
Verification's
built in. You trust the system.
You trust the system because you don't have to verify.
Yes.
It does it for you.
The algorithm and the network, the way it's decentralized, does it for you. The way that the ledger, writing the ledger down, the transactions, it's there for everyone.
And it's funny because people And you want to talk about trust in authoritarian structures that we have built into our society, right? Whenever you talk to someone who doesn't know anything about crypto, the first thing they say is they distrust it.
Oh, of course.
And they ultimately distrust it, and then they compare it to a cryptocurrency, to a dollar, and say, well, what's backing that crypto? There's nothing backing it, like the dollar. The dollar at least is backed.
And that's just ignorance. They don't know.
And then if you actually do the exercise and say, well, what is the dollar backed by? It's not backed by anything.
Trust.
It's confidence. Trust in the exact same way, right? Like the U.S. government used to be the day you could go get gold for a dollar. That doesn't exist anymore. And the government can print as many dollars as they want. It's backed only by confidence in the worth of the paper, of the dollar.
So let's stay here because another...
So that's interesting trust. That's a huge trust.
The next topic I wanted to talk about was money and trust.
Yeah.
So I like this analogy. Trust is like money. It takes a long time to earn and 1 second to lose.
Yeah, like reputation and credit.
Mm-hmm. Oh, reputation and credit. Yeah, same thing.
Yeah.
So... very interesting. So money and trust. So we've got that analogy, but also then just we shift when we begin to deal with people, whether it's family and friends or business acquaintances, when a conversation goes to money.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we do.
And why? Think about what is money at its core. I just read a great book. It is about cryptocurrency. It's called The Internet of Money by Antonopoulos. Really good book. Anyway, the first third of the book is about the history of money and what it is. And the question he asks people in his audience when he's speaking, it's actually excerpts of all these different speeches he gave, is how long has money been around? And people throw out ideas. The answer is forever. Money's been around forever. Why? Because it is an expression of what we value. That is all money is. Whether it's a seashell, a pair of beads that my five-year-old and her friends in the classroom are using to transact.
Or a chicken.
A chicken.
Or fur.
Think about this. Imagine we live back in the day, the medieval times, when you used gold to actually exchange things. And I want to buy that shield and that sword. Here's a little bit of gold. And then in comes third party and says, hey, why don't you give me all your gold? I'm going to give you this piece of paper.
Right.
And this piece of paper, it's paper from a tree, it's worth that. So I would have to trust that. We take all of that for granted now.
It took hundreds of years. It's a really good book. If anyone's interested in what we're saying here and really want to learn it, it took hundreds of years for that to become an acceptable thing. They were laughed out. Like, yeah, right. Get the hell out of here.
Right.
You're telling me your piece of paper is worth my gold? Like, go take a hike.
Paper versus gold.
But here's the question. Why were they incentivized to do that? Because gold's heavy.
Yeah, it's hard difficult to carry around, to transact.
To store and whatever. So these governments instead said, look, let's just take all the village's gold because if you lose it, it's a pain. If you want to carry it around, you got to carry around a sack of gold.
Well, not just that, but then it's
storing it.
It's fungible and not fungible. Like $1 equals another dollar. You can spend it the same way. Gold, it is, but you'd have to break it down to certain sizes.
Right.
So then you're having to carry around, I guess, your gold tools to get the right sizes.
Yeah. So but
anyway,
bottom line is there's all like for functional reasons, trust in that paper became a means of efficiency and effectiveness in the same way that we're talking about at the beginning. Trust in each other makes life more efficient and effective.
Think about which country does he mention where there's the $1 trillion bill? Think about countries with that crazy hyperinflation, Germany in the 20s, where they're burning their money.
Venezuela.
Why? Because there's no value.
Yeah.
Currently, Venezuela. There's no value in it. It's not worth anything. There's no trust, no confidence in the government that was supposed to be supporting it.
That's
so
what
now
leads
we're burning
hyperinflation.
Exactly.
Once you lose trust in the government and the money,
in the people that we've elected to help represent our interests, there's no trust there, then the currency, the exchange mechanism that is supposed to express what we value as groups of people becomes obsolete.
Yeah, and I'm not an economist, but I think it all comes back to you trust in that government's ability to pay their debt. right?
Well,
that's what it is.
We could have a whole another. Yeah. We should have a whole another episode on debt.
Yeah,
personal versus government.
Because everyone would be like, "Well, what's the best thing you could buy? A U.S. government bond, right? It's got a percentage interest. There, you know, they're going to pay it. They're the U.S. government. They've never not paid their bills." That's where that trust lies.
Well, because we just change the rules of the game for when our bills are due. That's what we do.
And we change the amount of the bill.
We affect the interest rate on the bill.
It's so nuts. But, you know, games that's really interesting. Games that people play to maintain trust in a dishonest way.
Well,
right? Sort of like a magician.
Yeah.
Right?
Smoke and mirrors, man.
Talk about cult things, right? So they use the smoke and mirrors to create a false sense of confidence within their group, within the people they're preaching to.
Within their ritual, within their dogma.
Yeah. And then the people take those things, and as long as they believe in them, as long as they are genuinely fooled by them, it builds their trust in that
process. Process and profit.
Yeah.
So if you want to learn about cults, read The True Believer by Eric Hoffer. He doesn't critique cults, but he studies a wide variety of them over a couple hundred year period and just talks about why they're powerful, why that social structure, a cult, has been around so long, modern society still. This was a guy that was self-educated and ended up winning the Presidential Medal of Freedom, and this book is really good. And at its core, it's about trust. It's manipulating people's sense of trust.
You know, that goes to something that when I was researching this, it said that we have a tendency to trust. Humans are born with a tendency to trust.
Well, it's your pantry example.
Yeah.
A baby, if it's going to stay alive, is dependent 100% on another person. So that is literally building neurological and physical dependence and trust from the beginning.
Yeah, and it said once we're betrayed that there are actual neurological changes that happen in our brain that make it harder for us to trust the next time. And I mean, it went into the mechanism of it. Something that would be important to point out is like the hormone and neurotransmitter oxytocin, it increases trust. And it does so by suppressing neural systems that regulate our fear of betrayal.
So that's why ecstasy was the hug drug being used, because it helped create trust. That makes sense.
Yeah, and it releases
the physical
oxytocin.
Chemicals that help lead to trust, or the behavioral expressions that we see in trust, there's a chemical background going on there. Is that what you're saying?
Yeah, that's exactly what I'm saying. And I'm saying that over time, when you get betrayed, the way that your brain releases oxytocin changes.
Man, this
Isn't
is a little...
Nuts?
Yeah, it is. And it's scary to me. Because where my brain goes with all this and where society is going, study the pharmacological innovations in the last 30 years. Study how much money those industries have. Study how much money they give to our politicians. And then read the book Brave New World. Where we're going to get is, you need to increase trust with people? Here, take this. You need to do this little action? Take this. Mm-hmm. And it'll be scientific, because that grand narrative is going to continue marching into our lives. But we're going to be regulating. Alexa will be regulating our chemical systems.
Depending on what we need people to get done. Or what class of society you are. I view it like Star Trek, right? Like, what is your job? We need Spock to be emotionless. We need this group to be very trusting, you know, because that is what they get
but
done.
But okay, so this institutional distrust that we have, you know, that Trump's really good at fueling, the media. I can't stand when people just talk about the media together.
Right.
It's so dumb. And I get it. A lot of media sucks, and they get in these loop cycles and talk about the same stuff. But at the end of the day, what I view is technology companies are becoming untouchable, too big to fail. They're becoming, eventually, we're going to look at Bezos and the Google, Larry and Sergey. They already are cult-like figures. And
Elon Musk.
It's just Elon Musk, perfect. And I like Musk. But we look to these people, and people put their full trust in the companies that they're producing, and they forget that these organizations are part of a capitalist economic background and a democratic society from political background.
Well, I mean,
there's a lot of issues.
Talk about trust. What's Google's say? Do no evil.
Yeah, they moved away from that, but for years that was what they were saying.
Yeah, it's like trust us.
Yeah.
Hey guys, we're gonna gather all the information about you that we can. Like, we're going to know everywhere that you're at. We're going to know where you were at before you came where you're at and how long it took you to get there.
And we're going
to
tell you where you should go. We're going to make suggestions for where you should go.
And we're going to track everything that you've ever searched and the way that you were going to put categories on you about your interests and things that you like. And we're going to pitch.
And the crazy thing is that is hegemony at its best. And that is a term that means your willing participation in your own domination. That's true. The company's doing that, but every one of us fucking signed up for it and uses Google, uses Facebook. Like, we're just like, okay, because we didn't read that fine print. But my opinion is, even if people did, they'd still use it because there's too many positive functions with the technologies.
And I love how, speaking of tricks around trust, I love how the, you know,
tricks around trust.
If you're going to use any of these services, you have to accept their terms and conditions, right? And so they give you this like 100-page thing.
Literally.
There was a study that came out that said if humans had to actually read and digest the terms and conditions that they agree to, they would do nothing else. They would have zero.
That would be our life.
Yeah. We would be just reading terms and conditions that we click. Ooh. Oh, yeah.
A terms and conditions bot to actually read through all that and then give us potential courses of action. I'd buy that.
Oh, that'd be cool. But anyway, but you get what I'm saying. Like, we do that because we have no other choice than to trust.
Yeah, we have to.
If we're going to use the service.
We choose to because it make it easier for
because
us.
We're like, oh, I want this efficiency
or
in my life.
Think of these billboards. Okay, here's a little goofy change challenge, people. The next time you're driving and you see ads on billboards, they're all ads, but like an attorney's ad, try to pay attention as you drive by because at the bottom, legally, there is some legal information at the bottom. How is it even legal? Oh, you got to have your disclaimer on there. There's no way to potentially read it other than pulling over and getting out binoculars and looking at it. It's but like, the system would say, hey, you got to trust us. We told you on the billboard. Look, it's right there.
Yeah, it's like people make fun of drug commercials because they'll be like, oh, it might cause a child born with the head of a golden retriever, you know? And you're like, what? But people are like, what? I mean, and it says the absolute worst things that you could possibly say. Like, may cause death. Oh, and during trials, there were increased incidences of cancer. You know what I mean?
Monkeys will murder your family.
But I mean, it's like, what is the worst thing that could happen? Death. And they're like, it causes
that. That's part of it.
Yeah. What about, you know, like cancer? Yeah, that's part of it.
Well, let's switch gears real quick, unless you have something else. So we've talked a lot about trust, but there's a flip side to that, and that's distrust.
Yeah.
So it's easy to distrust groups of people. We've talked a bit about that. Either groups you don't interact with, communicate with, clearly don't collaborate with, or groups that you dehumanize internally or externally on Facebook. But what about your friends and your family and your coworkers who you do have trust with, but it breaks down, right? Things occur where mistrust and distrust pop up. So what do you think about that? I have some thoughts, but I'm curious what you think.
Probably has something to do with how you were treated when you were a child and how your ability and your willingness to trust and whether you were betrayed, you know, in some large way or humiliated in some large way. And then I think it just becomes pervasive in your life, right? So not only do you trust distrust strangers and stuff like that, but you get this inability to form bonds and close relationships. I know people like that, you know, and I would love to like figure out what it was that happened to them when they were young that caused them to have that problem, because it actually becomes a problem in their life. If we're talking about we were talking about it from a surface level, saying trust in others leads to efficiencies. But let's also say, can you love someone without trusting them? Love and trust to me seem to go hand in hand.
There's probably, an enlightened person has a general sense of love for all people on the planet, but most people aren't, you know, enlightened, definitely not regularly enlightened. So,
and some people I feel like cannot fully allow themselves to love.
Right. And so I would say trust, I would say for immediacy, right? People in your close life, I would think trust and love are very positively correlated, but in the general sense of trying to love humanity, you don't meet people on the other side of the planet. You can love them, but can you trust them? I don't even think it's an appropriate question for me.
But I would still say, like, if I'm going to go out in the general public and be in a crowd of people and determine how my behavior is going to be around those, right? Well, if you would read the Bible and talk about how Jesus interacted with crowds and the lowest in society, it was he loved everyone, right? And therefore, he trusted everyone. He would go have dinner with the tax collector.
Right.
He would mingle with the prostitutes and allow Mary Magdalene to wash his feet.
I get it. But to extend your metaphor, what I'm saying is we didn't read much about Jesus hanging out with Aborigines in Australia.
I know. Because
so that's what I'm saying. I could go pray for hours for love for the people in Syria right now. But I'm not even going to think about, do I trust them? Because I'm never going
to
meet them.
You don't
I'm
have
never
to interact be with them.
That's what I'm saying.
Yeah, and I get that. But I think the idea is, if you did interact with them, would you trust them? Well, and I would say,
I trust them more easily than the people that were in control of their government.
Yeah, but you get what I'm saying.
Yeah.
I just think that there's this inherent tie.
Sure, they're correlated.
I think trust
for
and love
sure.
are different, but they're really intertwined. Yeah.
To me, I think about when you're in this situation and you mess up. Yeah, Dave, I'll pick you up and I'll take you to your prospect meeting with your big client coming up. And then I don't. I no call, no show. Right? That's going to be... Well, now, we have 28 years of friendship, so you'll be mad at me. You'll call me out. Hopefully, I apologize. But then you'll probably move on and eventually just forget that it even occurred. We have 28 yeah. years. Yeah.
And the next time I would have a big meeting, I would call you again for a ride.
Right, yeah. It might pop in your head, and you might be like, hey, pick me up. But you'd still ask me because you'd know I'd do it. But my point is, on that distrust side, to get back in the positive ledger side of trust as an asset, you need to be accountable and responsible.
Absolutely. Go listen to
our... And you need to own up when you mess up. So that's another way to maintain trust is when you mess up, own up.
Well, there's that honesty.
Yeah.
Right? Well, so when we're talking about lying, why people lie, it's to try to maintain... They think that if they lie and they get away with it, then they will maintain whatever reputation...
Power.
And political capital that they had prior. But oftentimes that's not true. Oftentimes I respect someone who just admits that they messed up. You know what I mean? Because I'm like,
because
I can see that that's pure honesty, right? They are making themselves vulnerable. They are being honest. You know,
the buck stops here.
Saying the buck stops here. That goes to our accountability episode, which I think it was one of the first ones we did.
It was an early one. It's a good one.
One of my favorite ones.
It's a good one.
If you guys, anyone, any new listeners who haven't listened, go check out the accountability episode. Everything that we're talking about here, I think,
well,
ties back
to it. I mean, again, where we're at with Life Lab as a whole up to now is talking about the principles that lead to the good life. We're talking about, this is a value-based podcast up to this point about what we believe, Dave and I, lead to a good life. And it's not easy. It struggles regardless of the social class or who your parents were, or, you know, what kind of struggles you had as a kid.
And it's pushing your boundaries both ways, right? So everything's a spectrum. And wherever you fall on that spectrum, try to go to extremes in both directions with these change challenges that we give. See what that's like.
The lying conversation sparked something in me. I think habitual liars, pathological liars.
We never even got there.
We didn't get
so
there.
Good.
Yeah, and it's a good.
Well, no, this is good. We're talking about trust.
Yeah,
let's
trust.
Talk about this.
So, I believe if I'm putting on my psychoanalysis cap and setting a pathological liar in my chair or couch, I believe they can't trust themselves. So they've invented a lot of masks and personas, if you will. Because they've never sat down and thought, who am I? And accepted who they are. They might be aware of it to a degree, but they might not. They either don't like it or they don't feel like they have some kind of core in there. And so they lie and create this labyrinth and Byzantine of bullshit because they don't trust themselves.
Wow, this touches on so many things. So first of all.
That just popped in my head. That
yeah,
wasn't like,
I love it.
That was just random.
They don't love themselves.
And, ooh,
and I think
even
there's,
deeper,
that, there's
yeah.
that tie between trust and love again. But I don't want to derail what you said. What you said was so awesome. Another thing is talking about our self-actualization/character, the character that you're building and the person that you are trying to become. Mm. We're always becoming something new. We're always working and striving towards something new. Wherever they are consciously or wherever they are currently evaluating themselves and that journey to become the person that they want to be, they are not who they want to be. And they have to compensate for it by making up.
Inventing it.
Inventing this whole new character, this person that they do want to be, or Not even the person that they want to be, the person that they think others
they want,
would want them
yes,
to be.
That others would expect them to be. They're living the life that others expect of them.
Or even that others would be interested in, or maybe they don't feel that others are interested in them. And so they have to lie to get others' attention.
Just maybe think about that, man. I know with my addiction to booze towards the end, I had drank the fun out of it. Another way to say it is I couldn't trust myself with alcohol anymore. Definitely not like an all-day drinking scenario at a football game or something. I'd just become Mr. Hyde, a jerk. But even towards the end, it's like I couldn't trust myself because I knew one drink would lead to 10 or more. Mm-hmm. And that was a problem. Now, I never got into the cycle of lies with it, luckily, but I could imagine whether someone's addicted to lying, just the distrust and the internal stuff that they feel about themselves that I was feeling.
Well, you know
it's
what?
It's powerful.
When we talked at the lying episode, and I think we gave someone a change challenge to go out and lie.
Yeah.
You know, like at a party or something. There's this weird, like, rush that you get, right? When you're fooling someone else to its fullest.
I had a good lie recently.
You get what I'm saying?
Yeah.
Okay, I want to hear it.
No, I don't want to share it.
Oh, okay.
But it was good. It didn't hurt or injure anyone. It allowed me to get out of a situation that was important. And, I'm comfortable with it, is all I'll say. So I fulfilled that one.
So I wonder if there's not something addictive about that rush that when you are fooling someone, you know, putting on a front.
There's chemistry behind it.
There's not something that's like, and then you get into that. And then on the flip side, it's like, well, what's the motivation behind that? Your motivation to drink, I think, is probably chemical, neurological. There's some dependencies there. But also it's just habitual and emotional, right? Like you felt like that's who you were, right?
Yeah it was all three.
Yeah, and so and you got comfort out of it and all this stuff. When I think about somebody who's a pathological liar, I wonder if it doesn't follow similar mechanisms. But I think it has to stem with a dislike for themselves.
That, like, and childhood, of course. And people don't like hearing that, but everything's connected. That's for sure.
Well, and like when we say pathological liars, let's just explain what we're talking about here. Like, we know people who have
invented jobs they've had, invented programs they attended, invented who knows how many specific, like, individual stories that they shared. A topper is a good example. Mm-hmm. Somebody that likes to top stories. Mm-hmm. Right? There's a difference between a general topper and a pathological liar.
Right.
A pathological liar will top other people's stories, but they will find a way to create a narrative thread through all their topping stories for how they're all connected. It's like they've truly storyboarded out a character in a movie that they've created, and they're just starring as that character.
And there have been a couple, and that later we find out all this stuff to be untrue, you know, and they stick to, like, if they get confronted.
Well, they double down.
I mean, I think it's like once you have one lie, right, then if you get caught in a lie, that's basically your opportunity to be like, all right.
Accountability.
Do I become an accountable person and really reveal my true nature, my true character? Right?
In this scenario.
In this one scenario. Or do I double down? And I think.
Well, whatever's in them, they double down every time.
Well, here's the crazy thing about pathological liars. It's like. They don't even get – it's like in poker, like if you get called, right, then you have to show your cards. But if you don't get called, then you get to decide whether you're going to raise the ante, right, whether you're going to raise the wager or the bet, right? And pathological liars, they won't even get called, and they'll just start – they'll just
– keep raising it.
Let's see what I can do.
They always play no-limit trust.
Yes.
No-limit trust.
They're like, I'm going to take this up a notch just to see when somebody's going to call me because, my God, the stuff that I'm spewing is...
You know, a lot of what we talk about does tie into psychology, right? The science of our mind, and our mind is crazy because we have to use our mind to overcome our mind in certain deficiencies and defects. But, man, it really does sometimes make me want to become a psychoanalyst or a psychiatrist and just learning and listening to people. It could be really empowering, or it could be just terrible.
Yeah, that's true.
Or probably both.
That's true. I mean, it's very interesting. You know, it's funny because every topic that we talk about, one of the things I do in my research is I go read the psychology about it because we're influenced by the way that our brain works around all of these things.
Okay, here's something I just thought of, and we're at about 53 minutes, so we got a few more minutes. We've talked a lot about this. We are so lucky and fortunate to have a big group of friends still that we've had for a long time from high school. Shit, some friends from grade school. Amen, you know? here's something that I thought of. What makes us unique? And I know there's hundreds or thousands of other groups that probably feel the same thing we do. We have trust. We have really good trust with a big group of people. Why? Well, I know for me, my perspective is I've gotten into and out of trouble with these people. I've seen these people at their best. I've seen these people at their worst. I've been at my best and worst with them, and we've gotten through it together, and that's strengthened that bond. Going back to what your grandma went through, we've gone through some degree of misery, first world misery, so to speak, right?
Yeah.
We have trust. And so I know when I've even traveled and met people, and I've been had one of my good friends with me, people comment. They're like, man, you guys just get along. You're just different.
Well, and it's also like we're a verification network. You know what I mean?
We have distributed ledger technology, trust built in.
Because, like, you know, we are talking about some people who we found out are pathological liars, and the whole network knows. And there's
no more consensus.
Yeah,
they can't.
That person.
Okay.
They will never be able to do another transaction on the network.
That's right.
Because everyone in the network,
they might be able to with individual nodes, with individuals. Maybe one individual just forgive and forget. Forgive, not forget. And so, you know what? I'll give you a second chance.
Right.
But that's highly unlikely and not probable to occur.
Right. And I think that maybe that's the way it works in tight-knit communities.
That's a great analogy, by the way.
Yeah.
Nice.
Tight-knit communities, like small towns, you know, like
religions. Congregations.
Anything like that, where you have, like, small, tight-knit communities. And I think we're very lucky that we were able to have grown and built a small, tight-knit community that even can be geographically dispersed, and I think technology has facilitated that. But we spent time together building that that emotional trust, right, that affect trust when we were young. And that's allowed for the extension of it into cognitive trust.
So the last thing I want to say on this, and then we can switch to anything you want.
It's on what you're saying.
Can I flip this?
Oh, okay. Sure.
No, you go.
Well, it ties back to crypto and really just online mediated communication, communicating with people through technological devices. So there's all these chat forums, and those have been there a long time. I'm talking about ones that relate to gaming, online gaming. These people don't know each other. They know each other through the mediated system, but they trust each other. And I have very clear examples of how that occurs. Now, do they have that deep, affective, feelings-based trust? Well,
maybe.
Face value, no. But how do they try to create it? Through the memes and emoticons and humor. Humor online is a mechanism and vehicle to try to create that feeling-based trust. So one quick story. We have a friend who's very into these communities and is kind of a big deal in some of these online gaming communities. He was playing a game. He or she was playing a game, and the game turned out to be a scam and ended up taking a lot of this person's money. The community rallied around our friend. Community of online people. This person had never met these people. They don't even know where they are in the world. They all have these online monikers and made-up names and little icons. They, through their tech competence, somehow built out a new game and site and were able to siphon back using the original scam game's rules. They manipulated them in a way to not only get this person all his or her money back, but and then some from the scammer. And this occurred over about a two-week period. And it's big dollars and cents, people. It's not a small amount. That's crazy to me.
That's crazy. But I'll say within games, there is shared experience.
Mm-hmm.
So if they played games with this person and built a bond.
So there's trust.
They probably built an emotional bond.
You play by the rules. Yeah, I trust you.
Exactly. Like you're playing a game together, right? You have an opportunity to betray other players. If you don't, you get up a reputation as a team player, as a good, honest person, and then Yeah.
And so scammers are just liars in the business world. They have no trust. People can't trust them.
And they typically build up false personas so that they can do it over and over again.
Yeah. Well, they're good at that.
Mm-hmm. I mean, there's a guy. So not talking about the gaming world, but let's talk about people who just are put out content and pretend to be experts in certain areas. So like YouTube, it doesn't matter what you get into. There's going to be a handful or 20 or 50. It just depends on how big the community is. Of quote-unquote experts that will give you advice in the area, right? It could be financial planning. You'll get those people on YouTube trying to do their financial planning advice. They're trying to become the next Susie Orman, you know. It could be fishing. It could be whatever. You know, fishing. I'm sure there's fishing gurus on YouTube showing you what lures to use when certain lighting and certain waters, and it's going to catch these types of fish. They build up these characters and these persona by giving out advice, you know,
sharing
by building
knowledge
a community,
and expertise,
giving their time, and then they build this community of followers and supporters, right? And online, I mean, we could get so into this because the psychology of it is amazing, because there are people who are like against them for no reason, for no apparent reason, who are
jealousy.
Trying to tear them down.
Yeah, it's jealousy and envy.
Whatever. And they're posting this stuff. But what I was going to say is they build a community through being somewhat of a, by being giving of their time, of their advice, of their knowledge, or whatever. And if a bunch of people benefit from the things that they're giving, that's what I think builds up that trust for them. And I think in a game, it becomes even more personal, because I'd be like, I played with that guy. He took care of me. He helped me out. You know what I mean? Like,
yeah.
Then you really build that trust. Or if it's just the guy who gave out the advice, you go out and try their system, right? And you'd be like, yes, I caught like 4 more fish because of that dude's trick that he showed me. It's really improved my life. Then all of a sudden they've got that trust that they've built with you. And then I can see where a community would rally around them.
Right, yeah.
Well, like, it's all tribal,
man.
That
tied to a lot of other things. I mean, just the idea that we trust others who look like us more readily than those that don't. Others who adopt similar philosophical, political, religious paradigms that we do. In your tech community, right? The early adopters and the innovators at the beginning of the curve, they just naturally are going to trust each other because they're diving into all kinds of innovations, whether they know it's going to work or not, because they believe they serve a function to getting it out to mass production. So they're innovators are going to naturally trust other innovators because they're just in it. They're in it all the time.
That's true. And because they just know that if this doesn't work, they're on to the next. So I think
exactly.
It's like, so they're comfortable with the consequences of the trust failing. Let me say this. Let's flip the script on the last few things that we've talked about. I know we're running out of time, but we talked about how we were so lucky to have this tight-knit community of friends that we have that have trust in each other, right? Well, let's flip that script let me ask the question. Can you imagine growing up in a poor, impoverished community that's always at war with each other, where there is no trust?
Footloose?
Exactly.
No, okay. I can't. And I can't even empathize with that because my experience was just so different.
Yeah.
I mean, I feel bad for those people, but I just didn't have that experience. So all I could do is listen and nod.
But if we talk, let's just take it to its, let's just say, I can imagine it. I can't empathize with those people,
imagine.
But I can imagine a world where that is true. And then if we talk about what the benefits of trust were, right? Efficiency, inactivity between others and being able to get things done. You can see why those communities turn out to be just complete disasters because nothing can get done. There is no trust between anybody. Any shared activity breaks down.
Right.
It's
well, and then let's take it back to one thing we talked about earlier. So what if the entire institution of media, institution of education, institution of banking, just imagine, hypothetical scenario, they just collapse. I don't see that as being good if that occurs. And a lot of people are trying to tear all those things down very quickly.
Right.
And
that
will lead to a lot of other problems.
Yeah,
going
it's
on.
Like the difference between evolution and revolution, right?
It is the exact difference.
Yeah, so everyone thinks that they want our government to completely collapse and fail because they distrust it and they want a revolution, but they've never been through what a revolution
is. Right. And as a
libertarian, like.
A self-identified libertarian, it's like, I'm not about, let's just tear it all down.
Yeah, you want to see riots and wars in the street, and then like that's revolution. Like,
yep.
The government
revolution
fighting the people.
Involves violence. Just remember the yeah. V revolution
yeah.
violence.
Yeah. So that's interesting. So yeah. So lack of trust, man. Think about how important. Just what we described, right? We described chaos, rioting, revolution, violence.
No structure, chaos. Yeah.
That's a world with no trust, man.
Yep.
That's a nightmare. And then let me take a step out and let me ask my other question. When we said that there are these people who build up this trust in these communities and then the communities rally around them, technologically speaking, because we were talking about YouTube and the gaming world, what about the people in those worlds that become villains because they are outed for scamming? So there's a guy named Ian Bellina who is a cryptocurrency
guru.
Guru, yeah. The word guru is pretty good. And he would recommend new investments to his followers, and he would say that the team behind this new cryptocurrency project is so great and what they've already accomplished is good, and he would basically be getting his community to invest in some of these things. And it came out, you know, that he was getting paid by some of these projects.
Yeah, shillings. It's called shilling.
To shill and to do quote-unquote pump and dumps, where he would pump it to his community and say, oh, guys, this project's amazing. The people behind it are amazing. They're going to change the world. You know, you guys really should invest in it. And then his whole community would go pump the price of it up. And then, of course, he had bought beforehand. And after it got pumped up, he would sell it. And he was getting compensated by that project team to be doing that same thing. And it came out that that's what he was doing. And he is, he's a villain now out there. And anything that he says is deemed to be untrue. I would assume he's going to have to create a new, if he's going to try and go down.
I disagree. We're going to have to end soon, but I disagree. At face value, it makes sense. But think of the WWF. Think of the WWE. The world is full of villains, baby. And villains, if the villain is comfortable being the villain, and they care about money and they have an ability to make money, they can be the villain.
Yeah,
they can be the villain.
So you think it's like a better strategy for him to just embrace
if he is of if it his character and his soul, if that's how he thinks about things, he can be the villain and live in his eyes the villain life and be the villain.
That's true.
You know, it's not the life I think is worthwhile. It's not the type of person I would want running any institutions or organizations I want to associate or do business with. But those people exist.
Yeah.
And if they think, hey, I got money, that's what's of value to me. I'm living my life. Well, okay, brother.
Yeah.
You know what I'm saying?
No, I do. I do. And maybe, unfortunately, they build trust with another community.
Right.
Another
audience. They'll keep doing it. Right? And they'll take advantage of people not knowing their ignorance or giving people the benefit of the doubt and
forgiveness. Well, just be really cynical and say, because I'm trying to think from a strategic perspective, what do I do if I'm that guy? If I'm going to be cynical about it, I'm going to go, yeah, that's right. I fooled all those sheeple and look how much money I made.
Right.
Turn around and say, I'll teach you how to do it too.
Yeah. They just
and just build
teach
a new community
exactly.
of scammers. Yeah.
Well, I'm going to actually have to go soon. So let's do some change challenges.
All right.
I have a simple one. We talked about that people take trust for granted. Find someone that you trust and that trusts you and give them a message, a phone call, not a text, not an email, a phone call, and just tell them you love them and tell them thank you for being able to trust. Thank you for your trust and be grateful. Acknowledge that it's there. I think that's powerful.
I love that. I love that. Hey, I've got one that I think is fun and playful.
Good.
When you prank someone, typically you prank the people that you love and that have some sort of level of trust with you, right? Because they
or people that work at Hardee's.
They allow themselves. Yeah, we'll talk about that. So they allow themselves to be vulnerable in a way that they wouldn't do with other people. They trust you, right? But a good prank exploits that trust in a fun way.
Ooh,
that is not
like
harmful,
where you're going. Yes,
right?
Do it.
So here's a great example, right? So sitting in an office, a person has their computer up, leaves it logged in. They have their chat client up. We see this and we're like, okay. And this just happened this week. We got to make him pay. So we get up, get on his computer, and send to one of his peers, right? So someone who's also fairly high up at the company. Hey, I forgot to wear underwear today.
Didn't leave it.
Let me say, I know it sounds embarrassing, but I had to tell someone, so I thought you should know.
That is awesome. And then we just leave it up, right, and go sit back down and just wait for the reaction. You know what I mean? Because it's so fun. It was a fun game.
Well, what was it?
Well, he comes back into the room and sits down, and then we see him, like, chatting back and forth with this person, and he turns around and he asks us, did anyone else come in the room when I was gone?
And we're like, nice.
We're like, no, nobody else came in. He's like, really? Like, this guy, like, Brian didn't come in? Because I guess Brian, speaking of trust, must have pranked him in the past.
Oh,
right?
Great.
And he's like trying to figure out how this could have happened, right? And we're just like trying not to laugh between ourselves.
That's
and
awesome.
Finally, after a while, he's like, ponder. And I was like, yeah, and I started laughing.
Oh,
you know?
That's great.
Yeah.
Nice. Well, do that. Do something fun.
Do a fun prank where you see what it's like to exploit trust in a harmless way. And then imagine if you were a terrible person, what you could do.
Oh, I'll share a good one. One of my closest friends has, in the past few months, has recently shared a few words that he hates, he can't stand, and they're very innocuous words. And he should have never shared those with me, because I've shared them now with many of our other friends. So whenever this person sends a text message or just shoots us an email or something, we all just respond with these one or two words he hates.
And sure is cool.
One of them. Cool is another one. And juxtaposition. He hates the word juxtaposition.
Really?
So we just use those all the time. And he hasn't caught on yet. I don't think that he knows I am doing that. Oh, it's funny though.
He caught me.
So trust, do that. Well, anything else, Dave?
No, I like the prank one. I think that's a good one. And yeah. I think it's one where you can have fun with it, and then you can allow your mind to wander and say, okay, this is why trust is such a valuable thing.
Yeah, which also ties back to not taking it for granted.
Also, notice how that person will be on their toes for you to prank them again. And that goes to show you how trust is built, and it takes a long time to build it up again.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah, we got to add an episode on humor. We haven't done one on
humor.
No,
we haven't.
Nice. All right. Well, I think we got a couple good change challenges. I think you can hear how the energy built on this one. We started off and were a little more serious, a little applying that cognitive level. And I think we eventually got to more of an affective conversation, feelings-based, heart-based about trust. So that was kind of neat.
Yeah. No, very good.
Well, thanks for listening. And as we always say at Life Lad,
experiment with life.